You're listening to PorchDrinking.com's The Porchcast, brought to you by OnTap Credit Union. They listen carefully to your needs and make sure you have the right services, low-cost loans, and expert financial advice for you, your business, and your employees. Whatever your needs may be, tap into the services at OnTap Credit Union. And now, The Porchcast.
All right, folks, and welcome to episode... Always got to get that out of the system.
Yep, get that tip of the tongue, the teeth, and the lips.
Alrighty, folks, and welcome to episode 64 of The Porchcast. We've got a special edition with just me and Sam on the ones and twos. Sam and I are going to break it down today in a special edition of The Porchcast, our first broadcast since the Great American Beer Festival. But a lot's been going down, so that's why I wanted to bring Sam Sly into the mix. And Sam, we've got a lot to get to on this episode.
Indeed we do.
The bulk of the matter that we're going to be focusing on in episode 64 is going to be on growth in various different forms, as a lot of breweries have announced various different forms of growth over the past couple weeks. But before we get to that, solid transition, we're going to get into talking a little bit about our partners here at OnTap Credit Union. With locations in Golden and Arvada, OnTap Credit Union has supported brewery employees for over 64 years. They also support breweries, so for those breweries out there who are listening, they can help with financing growth in your own breweries, and they also can help to support your employees. They listen carefully to your needs, make sure you have the right services, low-cost loans, and expert financial advice for you, your business, and your employees. Whatever your needs may be, tap into the services at OnTap Credit Union. That's www.ontapcu.org. Very appropriate that we bring those guys up because a lot's been going on in the craft beer world since we last convened and spoke with Ken Grossman. Some of the notable topics that we're going to be getting to this week, talking a little bit about Founders Brewing. They had kind of an issue that resurfaced recently in terms of litigation. And, you know, because that happened a few weeks ago, we won't touch too much on that. But I definitely would love to get your kind of weigh in, Sam, because, you know, you grew up with Founders.
Absolutely.
They were part of where you're from in terms of the Michigan area. But also some news that kind of flew under the radar a little bit. Aspen Brewing recently sold to Legacy Breweries, and we had an exclusive interview with the Legacy Breweries team, their CEO. And then Scott Brewing recently announced that they were opening up a brew stillery in Boulder, Colorado. So in terms of diversifying, you know, that's kind of a different approach that we'd love to touch on a little bit as well. But the big story for the week, you know, nothing really happened this week, nothing at all. But actually...
Real quiet week, right?
Yeah, very quiet week for us.
You had nothing going on.
The whole reason that we actually decided to record this week was because of the big news coming from New Belgium Brewing, who announced on Tuesday that they have essentially been acquired by Kirin Holdings' craft beer branch, which was Lion Little World. And that's the craft beer branch of Kirin Holdings, the Japanese beer company. And all of that is pending an employee vote because they are employee owned, of course, but it's seeming like that is most likely going to happen. So let's jump right into it. Sam, the big news of the week, I would love to hear your initial reactions when you found out that New Belgium was getting acquired.
Yeah, it was a little bit of kind of shock and awe to the point where I didn't know how to feel. I mean, my initial thoughts when breweries get acquired, whoever it may be, actually not whoever it may be, usually my first initial thought is like, thank God it wasn't Anheuser-Busch, which I think is a lot of the things I saw echoing around. And then I kind of, honestly these days, when I hear about acquisitions, I like to sit back and process and one, I think about it, and two, see how other people react because for me, it's more interesting to see how people react because I'm more of a watcher, fly on the wall kind of guy.
Sure. It's funny you bring that up, you know, in terms of the Anheuser-Busch element. I think that was also my initial reaction.
Yeah.
That said, I think in looking at the trends of Anheuser-Busch's acquisitions, I think it would have been an even more unexpected shock if that were to have happened, because of their trend of generally buying breweries that are within the, I think, 40 to 60,000 barrels a year range, whereas New Belgium is now over 800,000. So I, you know, in kind of after the most recent acquisition of, is it Platform in Ohio, I think was their latest.
Ooh, I have been slacking on my tracking of that.
Well,
that sounds right.
We'll pull up our little stat boy here in a second.
Yeah.
But I think it's Platform Brewing.
That does sound familiar. So that's...
That was kind of a time when we kind of dug a little deeper, looked at the trends, and noticed that, you know, all of their acquisitions generally happened. It was Platform Beer out of Ohio was their latest acquisition. But all of their acquisitions generally fall within that, 60 to 100,000 barrels range.
Okay.
Whereas New Belgium is over 800,000 barrels.
Yeah, that would have been, that would have been one really shocking, because God knows how much money they would have to shill out for that. I guess we'll all kind of find out one way or the other. But I think that would have been a bigger kick in the balls for a lot of people too who are New Belgium fans, because of their history of, you know, the employee ownership and being an OG craft brewer for so many years, and, you know, Fat Tire's an institution.
Yeah.
And to suddenly see that under AB InBev's reign, I think a lot of people would have had a hard day.
Well,
harder day.
Probably. I definitely don't want to confuse folks. New Belgium was not acquired by ABI, not acquired by Anheuser-Busch. They were, in fact, acquired by Kirin Holdings craft beer branch, Lion Little World. And so, you know, you touched on a point just then with Fat Tire being such a iconic gateway beer. I think that also had a lot to do with people's shock reaction when they found this out, because I think for a lot of people who, you know, are in the craft beer world or have become fans of craft beer, for many of them, I'm sure Fat Tire was that gateway, and I'm sure New Belgium was a huge gateway brewery to bridge that gap between, you know, the Coors Lights, the Bud Lights, and getting into craft beer in general. So, I in my coverage on Porch Drinking, I noted that this acquisition to me kind of fit alongside, you know, a handful of major acquisitions that really signify kind of the state of where craft beer acquisitions are right now. And to me, that was Goose Island, which kicked it all off back in 2010. And then from there, I said, Ballast Point was another one because of the $1 billion mark.
Yeah, that was a huge price tag and kind of set a new, I don't know if I want to say pace, but a new kind of marker for what a brewery could be valued at to a larger company like that.
Now, I think we're starting to see that was an overvaluation, and I think that's come back to hurt Ballast Point in a lot of ways. More recently, they closed two of their California locations, their Trade Street location, which was a sour and barrel aging facility in San Diego, as well as their Temecula, California-based brew pub, and they also canceled plans to open up a brew pub in San Francisco. All of that, I think, partially because of declines in sales over the past 2 years, and then also because of the overvaluation, they haven't been able to meet that mark. So,
yeah.
But, you know, in terms of other major acquisitions, Founders, you know, we touched on that a little bit, their Mao San Miguel acquisition. I also think that Wicked Weeds acquisition by Anheuser-Busch was a huge one, mostly because of the fact that they are, you know, they were a more of this kind of indie, sour, kind of funk focused brewery that didn't seem like a normal target for Anheuser-Busch.
Yeah.
And that kind of really sent shockwaves. And we saw the huge response with many breweries kind of pulling out of Wicked Weeds, festivals and whatnot, and starting their own festival. But then from there, I think the next major acquisition was more of a merger earlier this year between Boston Beer and Dogfish Head. And to me personally, I think that was kind of the one where, you know, when that acquisition went down, or merger went down, basically acquisition, it signaled to me that anything was possible.
Yeah.
You have two iconic names and two iconic figures who kind of paved the way for craft beer, and fiercely, both of them, you know, fiercely independent, them kind of deciding that they were joining forces, you know, while they're still technically independent based upon the Brewers Association's definition, they're not outright independent. They're now like in partnership with each other. And
yeah.
And so that really signaled to me that, you know, anything's possible.
And on a different level for me, it was more cemented with the New Belgium announcement, is that even these like older, you know, older kind of, like I say, old school OG breweries, mm-hmm. that are regional, national, whatever level they're at, it seems like for them to continue on their trajectory, maybe they need some larger like capital infusion type things, or, you know, more resources, you know.
Absolutely.
If they're you know, they built it up to this point, and to keep going, they need more than what they're getting out of what, you know, they're selling on their own. You know, we've said, you know, the craft segment isn't growing as aggressively as it was 10 years ago, and, you know, everyone might be having to change their game plan a touch to keep up and stay in the game.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that you bring up a really good point. You know, when these acquisitions get announced, the main talking points always turn to, you know, well, you know, the company that we joined has guaranteed that they're not going to change anything. You know, they're not going to change our company culture. That's a huge reason why we joined. We decided to go with that company. The other thing that they say is, you know, the beer's not going to change. And then the other thing, you know, the other element is, you know, we need this as a means to, you know, greater resources, grow our distribution. You know, we have a better network to get our brand out there, blah, blah, blah. You know, it feels like a broken record at this point, but really it's true. I mean, like, especially with the landscape the way it is now in terms of competition being so high, you know, I think a lot of these OG brands are really looking around and saying, all right, well, you know, you've got two breweries like Boston Beer and Dogfish Head teaming up. You know, you've got the Constellation conglomerate, you've got the ABI conglomerate, you've got Canarchy. Oscar Blues and Canarchy. You know, at a certain point, we're gonna have to, you know, find our own little super team, you know, Justice League or Avengers team or whatever, to really help to grow our, you know, our presence and distribution and resources. And so I think, while it may sound like a broken record, I think it's really true.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing, I recently wrote an article called Brewery Acquisitions and What Does It Mean to Really Sell Out? But one of my main points in that is, you're looking around at, you know, New Belgium's acquisition yesterday, and you also look back at Avery's acquisition by Mal San Miguel, and both of those, I think, were in reaction to the fact that they've dropped multi-million dollars on brand new production facilities.
Yeah.
In New Belgium's case, in Asheville, I think it's a $175 million facility that they opened up in, what, I think 2017.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, when you're flatlining in growth and sales and you have this multi-million dollar facility, you're going to have to finance that in a certain way. Otherwise, your company is going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah. You can't keep investing if you're not continuing to be able to build on top of that, you
know, absolutely,
that bottom line that you always hear us business folk talk about.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a lot of, I think the natural, there's a couple natural reactions. I think there's a lot of shock and, you know, confusion, especially when it's a brand that you care about for so long. But at the end of the day, and then there's a lot of people who immediately say, oh, they've sold out.
Yep.
Well, one of the main points that I try to bring up in this piece, on porchdrinking.com is, you know, sure, you can easily just say that they've sold out, but what if you're doing this to protect the, you know, longevity of the company?
Mm-hmm.
What if you're doing this to protect the longevity of your employees? Because if you're not able to finance that $175 million facility in Asheville, you know, there are going to be layoffs, and people are going to lose their jobs. And, you know, what if this is a means to, you know, protect jobs and save jobs that are within the company? You know, you want to take care of your employees. And I think that's something that, you know, New Belgium has placed so much emphasis on, is, you know, wanting to take care of their employees, wanting to take care of their family. And so I can't say for certain, but, you know, the numbers are there. And when they're down 100,000 barrels in production from the previous year, it signals to me that, you know, there might be some struggles and they might need a little bit of cash infusion to help, you know, stabilize things a little bit. You know, one of the other things that I point out in the article is that when Wicked Weed got purchased, they were able to grow their staff by, you know, from 50 employees to over 350 employees.
Whoa, I never heard that stat. That's crazy.
Yeah, they were able to grow off-premise sales by 2.5 times their amount before acquisition. And so,
man,
you know, I think some of these infusions of cash, you know, sure, it might be selling out, but it also is in a sense protecting the longevity of your company.
Yeah. And you know, you're saying that, Tristan, kind of, I want to pose a question to you because I haven't really thought of it this way. The argument you hear a lot of people say is, well, now the money is going to, you know, out of country.
Sure.
Which to an extent is true, but I guess with the question I'm going to start asking myself and maybe posing to other people is, what's more important to you, the, you know, profit money going to a bigger parent corporation, mm-hmm. versus going, you know, up the company, getting however it might go there, or the jobs that are here in America being more secure?
Sure.
Maybe even having more opportunity to, you know, give those people a more secure position of secure future and stuff.
Well,
and, you know, because people are thinking of the altruism, I think. It's like, oh, you know, we got to keep everything here,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, it's great. I definitely support having jobs here in America.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't read me wrong there. But it's, I don't know, that's kind of a different way I'm starting to think about it. And it kind of just struck me right here, right
now. No, I think that's actually a really great point. And one of the things that I didn't really, that I regret not, and I'll probably go through and maybe try to update this a little bit more in my article, but I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind is that not every acquisition is the same.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, even especially in looking at an Anheuser-Busch acquisition versus, one of these acquisitions, there are different nuances to every single acquisition. Sure, I think that, you know, Anheuser-Busch has proven that, you know, when one of the biggest arguments is, well, the beer is going to change and quality is going to go down. Well, I think there are proven instances where, you know, the recipe has changed, mm-hmm. in terms of Goose Island's 312, you know, a lot of their IPAs and, you know, recipes do change. And I think that Anheuser-Busch has, in some cases, if you read, I think one of the biggest things that I recommend for folks is to read Josh Noel's book, Barrel Aged Stout and Selling Out. It goes really in depth into that Goose Island acquisition by Anheuser-Busch, and it talks about Anheuser-Busch as a whole, but it does mention, you know, cutting corners a little bit and, you know, outsourcing production to one of their regional sites versus, you know, beers being produced locally. You know, Goose Island beer is being produced in New Jersey or in Fort Collins versus right in their backyards in Chicago. And so, you know, that is one instance where I do think, you know, the quality has maybe gone down or mm-hmm. the recipe has changed. But, you know, you look at other acquisitions, and I don't think that, I think that, you know, those parent companies have remained true. I think that, you know, Mal San Miguel, especially that being a family-owned company, even though it is foreign, I think that from everything that I've heard from Avery, you know, friends of mine who work within Avery, things haven't changed. In fact, they've been able to get, if you look at their most recent releases over the past year, they've been able to do more creative, more innovative stuff and release newer brands throughout the year more frequently. You know, in taking a look at New Belgium, they're a company that's so rooted in company culture and wanting to protect, you know, this way of life within New Belgium. I think that Kim Jordan isn't going to, you know, approach this in a negligent way where she wouldn't include provisions that maintain that company culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe that's me being naive, but I think that there are certain elements that are going to be different within each acquisition. And I do think that there are some truisms that come with, you know, some of these, you know, publicity talking points that are in fact being, hopefully will be upheld.
If I may interject, actually, you saying that made me think of this too, is one of the big differences from the, you know, the acquisitions we're talking about with, you know, New Belgium, Avery, Founders and such, is that they're not being acquired by a company that has manufacturing on U.S. soil, as far as I know. You correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So Budweiser, AB InBev, my bad, has, you know, when they acquire a brewery, they're planning on ramping that up, taking on some of the production as well. Mm-hmm. So the whole narrative of nothing will change, everything's going to be the same, is easier to kind of poke a hole in that, because it's like, well, it's not going to stay the same because we're going to be taking a lot of this production and putting it in our facilities from AB InBev perspective.
That can't complete, that's not 100% true either, okay. Because I will say that I do know that there have been, especially in the case of Founders, All Day IPA is produced in Boulder as well.
I forgot about that.
And so,
touche.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, sure. I think there are instances where, you know, beer will be produced all throughout the family, you know, within that family conglomerate base. But you know, hopefully, it doesn't change the recipe. You know.
Yeah.
Sure. There will probably be small nuances, but I think in the case of Goose Island, we've seen extreme cases where, you know, ingredients are substituted for, you know, lower cost ingredients, and that's where you're seeing a lot of the displeasure and dismay. Yeah.
And I guess the other way I was going with this, which might be just thrown out the window, but it's the production systems could be very different because of the scale they're going from.
Sure.
Jumping from, you know,
absolutely,
like you said, 50 to 100,000 barrels to whatever the hell that facility they end up in is producing.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands of barrels.
You know, I've experienced, whether it's perceived or real, like as breweries scale up, you know, people always claim, the big one for me is Bell's and Oberon. I remember when I was in college, way back in the early 2000s, to age myself, is perceived or real, not everyone, but a lot of people I know is like, oh, Oberon doesn't taste the same because they had to change stuff up because they were brewing a hell of a lot more of it now than they were in 2003 and 2004. So I don't know if that has any...
But to go back to your question, I mean, I think that's a great one. I think that is an important thing to consider, and I think people are justified maybe in writing off breweries when, you know, a lot of the, you know, the taxes and you know, the money trickles up to a foreign owned entity, and you know, that's certainly the case with Anheuser-Busch, you know, being a Belgian owned company that also is based out of Brazil, has, you know, ties to, actually it's a Brazilian owned company now that has ties to Belgium. And so, you know, it's very convoluted in where that money is actually going. But, you know, not to defend or be an apologist, but I think you're right in saying that there are still elements of it that are complicated in that, you know, Goose Island does a lot within their community. Belgium does a lot within their community. And I don't think that that's going to necessarily change just because of an acquisition.
I think,
in fact, it would be really dumb for them to not continue to pump in more money into the community. You're seeing that even, you know, the first thing that Founders did after their recent fiasco is to double down on supporting, you know, diversity and inclusion in community groups within the neighborhood. And so, you know, that shouldn't be, I don't think that would be the first reason to write somebody off, but there are a multitude of other reasons that you may be concerned about.
Yeah. And the thing that keeps cropping up in my head is I have always done an analogy in my own head, and I talk with some people about music and beer, mm-hmm. and that people get very, very emotionally invested into a brand, a band. I mean, they're only one letter apart.
Yep.
And I remember going in high school, whenever a band would go from like indie to a major label, it's like, oh, they sold out.
Yeah.
They're going to suck now. And it's like, no. And I mean, I was as guilty of that as the next guy. I was such a little jerk about stuff, but if you think about it now, it's like that gave that band an opportunity to make a living. Those four or five people just now had a whole lot better chance to, you know, live their life, raise their families, do whatever it is they want to do. But the idea is that it gave them an opportunity to better themselves and get their music in front of more people, which ultimately, like, you want to see your band or your brand succeed.
Yeah.
And it's a conundrum, and it's that emotional attachment of now, like, oh, they're not they're not as cool or hip now because more, it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. Because more people are going to know, and it's like, oh, well, whatever. And I feel like a lot of people, they react very emotionally with beer when they, you know, totally. Do, quote-unquote, sell out because of that attachment like that.
I think it's fair to, you know, feel a little bit of sadness when something like that happens because, you know, you want things to stay the same. And you like picturing things in their golden era. For me, when it comes to New Belgium, I still very fondly remember a time when I first moved to Denver when, you know, one of my closest friends now was still working for New Belgium, Justin Patty. He actually, you know, inspired a lot of my, you know, approaches towards beer marketing. And I think he did so much for New Belgium in making the brand feel very local and feel like it supported local community groups and organizations. And I think that's when a brewery is at its height and when it at its strongest is when it's super plugged in and you know that they're authentically trying to support the community. And, you know, we love picturing that. And so when an acquisition like this, especially to a foreign company, happens, you wonder a little bit about, like, you know, is that going to continue? Mm-hmm. You know, does that completely change the landscape of, you know, the core values of what that brewery stands for? And, you know, I think the smart thing as a consumer to do is to just be keenly aware. And like you said, become someone who watches. And, and, you know, we can be reactionary when the time comes. But right now, I think it's a little bit irresponsible to be one of those people who is part of the cancel culture just because.
Just because of a change in.
I mean, it's a big change to do. Because you're a grump and you want no one to be rich or happy.
I want to stomp my feet and say, why the hell wasn't I an employee there? Now I want to do this or whatever. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of positives to the story, and it's the back and forth of it is what it is. And like I said, time will tell. That's the whole time you were just talking there. I'm like, time will tell how with New Belgium, if and how this will change anything in their culture. Mm-hmm. And I'm with you, man. I can't see them doing anything but using this as an opportunity to invest more in the, you know, the Fort Collins area and hopefully Asheville too, since they have the facility over there. You know, you want to support where your people at and you know, keep that going.
So. Totally. Now, I want to take a quick break, but before we do, you know, I do want to make sure that we touch a little bit on, you know, just especially in looking back in the nostalgia. After the break, I want us to dive into kind of what's happened over the past few weeks in terms of founders, and we'll touch a little bit on Ska Brewing and their brewstillery, which is kind of a more unique approach towards growth. We'll dive into that and more here in just a moment here on episode 64 of the Porchcast. Hang tight. We'll be back. Special thanks to our show sponsor, OnTap Credit Union. With locations in Golden and Arvada, OnTap Credit Union has supported brewery employees for over 64 years. They listen carefully to your needs and make sure you have the right services, low-cost loans, and expert financial advice for you, your business, and your employees. Whatever your needs may be, tap into the services at OnTap Credit Union.
Sam, earlier before the break, we were talking a little bit about New Belgium and the big acquisition, but I want to talk a little bit about Founders Brewing. You know, in between Great American Beer Fest and where we are today, you know, we had a little bit of a breaking news that to come out of the Grand Rapids area in terms of ongoing litigation at the time between Founders Brewing and Tracy Evans over a discrimination lawsuit. Now, the lawsuit took place over a year ago, but it kind of resurfaced in the public eye recently when during litigation, Tracy Evans's supervisor, manager at the time in the tap room, he testified and noted that, you know, he didn't see race. And when questioned by the lawyer, the attorney actually asked, so, you know, asking him if he knew what race Tracy Evans was, and he couldn't respond, saying that he didn't know his background, didn't know, you know, if he was actually a black man. And so, you know, the attorney
pushed further and asked, well, can you affirmatively confirm the race of Barack Obama? And his response was, well, I don't know his background. I don't know, you know, his ancestors, so I can't affirmatively confirm whether or not he is black. And basically the argument was saying that he didn't see race. And so, you know, that really brought this lawsuit to the public eye and became a huge, huge story for a number of weeks until recently when the two parties eventually did decide to settle. But something that did come out of it, the diversity and inclusion director who founders had hired earlier this year announced that she was going to leave amidst the news that came out from that litigation. So, you know, founders, in my take, this was the most tone-deaf approach towards, something that was a serious issue. Instead of tackling it head-on, Gracie Harkema, who was the diversity and inclusion director, noted that their focus, Founders' focus, was on solely on winning this lawsuit instead of trying to correct, some of the inherently racist things that took place. In Evans's original claims, he noted that there were instances where the N-word was used multiple times in front of him in the workplace, and each time he filed complaints again about it, and nothing was done. He also noted that there were employees that referred to printers as the white guy printer and the black guy printer, and again, many just things that would be baffling to hear. I couldn't even imagine that being made up. And so, instead of tackling these issues straight on, sure, they had a responsibility to, go through the lawsuit, but all along the way, it just felt like founders didn't actually want to address the issues that were at hand.
Yeah, I felt like they averted their eyes and just kind of was looking at the ground and waiting for the storm cloud to blow over more or less.
Sure.
And I agree. Tone deaf is probably the best way of putting it. I've been trying to sort out through my feelings of this whole instance through it and stuff. And tone deaf is the way to do it.
And as much as people can accuse me of being a New Belgium apologist, I'm sure, in a little bit of a sense, because New Belgium, I came up in beer, with New Belgium being a leading example. I'm sure for you, Founders was very much at the crux of your initiation into craft beer. So I'd love to hear kind of your reaction and how you feel after seeing all of this stuff started to bubble up.
Definitely. I mean, once the whole deposition came up and the whole issue came, right back up to the forefront, I remember when it started to go down, and I felt the same way then. I wanted to hear the whole story, mostly because it sucks to hear when your heroes do something really, really dumb.
Yeah.
And to your point, when the comments that were made and the things that were said, it's like, is this 2019 or what? Where are we? And it's such a shame because I've always had such good interactions with the founders, people that I've met. And I've only really, I've always been there as a patron. So I know bar staff. I met, I can't remember who it was, if it was Dave or Mark. I met one of the owners at Big Beers last year, and I was like a 12-year-old girl standing in front of Elvis trying to say hi. It was absolutely ridiculous. So, I've been a fan. I started going to Founders when I was like 24.
Yeah.
Was a Mug Club member. They were, as far as my beer puberty goes, they were they were my first. But so this whole situation, as the deposition comes up and all this stuff's coming out, it's hurt because we idolize heroes, people, and you can still idolize brands too because of the nostalgia, the experiences, and all the stuff you have. So for me right now, it's I'm waiting to see if they can, one, act on the things they're promising and do more of a, come off more human, I guess. And I mean, it's not a requirement for a company to come off as human, but for me, as someone who does marketing for a brewery and works at one, the connection, you need to have that human element. You can't go cold and be just this corporate entity. I mean, people will buy that don't know, but your diehard fans will know and they will talk and spread the word, and it'll it can eat someone from the inside out. I mean, I don't know if Founders is too big to the point where they can't escape from this, or if you know, they have to do something drastic. But
that's a good question. You know, I think in looking back on it, hindsight, not necessarily 2020 in this case, because I think there were some very blatant misjudgments on their part.
Yeah.
I think from the get-go, they should have, you know, there are a multitude of ways they could have corrected this, but from the get-go, they should have addressed when Evans brought up, you know, these issues, they should have tackled it head on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, even when the discrimination lawsuit came forward, I think they should have made immediate steps to correct and, you know, fires the people involved.
Yeah.
And also they should have settled immediately instead of letting this drag out. I think they should have come to a resolution where, you know, Evans got to, you know, express why this was hurtful and why this was wrong. And I think they should have taken ownership of this and also explained why it was wrong and why this should have been corrected.
Yeah.
But now that all of this has played out, I think you were just about to touch on it, and I'd love for you to dive deeper. At what point, is there a point where founders as a brand can recover from this, and you as a consumer feel like you can embrace or at least buy their products again? I don't know if you've ridden them off or are taking a break from founders because of this. I know many people are.
Yeah.
Many bars have already, you know, either dumped all of their founders products, or I know in some cases, which I think is the better approach, they've sold off everything that they have and donated, you know, the proceeds towards diversity, inclusion, you know, organizations, which is
that's awesome.
An awesome way to do it.
Yeah. I didn't realize that was something places were doing. I just read all the stories of people that were, especially in like the Michigan area, since I still have plenty of ties back
sure.
there, is the stores, and especially in the Detroit area, the stores and other retailers are just like, sorry, we're not carrying you now, which I totally get. And
yeah.
I, you know, absolutely agree with that.
Sure.
And, you know, to your question originally is, I don't know, to be honest with you. Like I am kind of just not buying and stuff. And
sure.
I don't know if it's conscious or just, I don't know. I just have a bad taste in my mouth.
Sure.
And I don't know exactly what it would be to flip it. And if it's a time thing, and for me personally, I it's one of those things kind of like with New Belgium, it's time will tell what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I do want to see them do more to take steps to address this and own it. I still think there hasn't been a real proper ownership
yep.
of it. I mean, I know statements have been made on both sides, and I don't know. I don't feel satisfied just
sure.
yet from it.
And I think that's a natural response. Absolutely. Now, I do want to end the show on more of a positive note. So let's talk a little bit about kind of this more unique approach towards organic growth and, you know, diversifying your portfolio a little bit. I think, you know, I've got an article that I'm working on right now, but in looking at Ska Brewing, I think now they're within one of the top 10 breweries in terms of size in Colorado that is still independently owned. After the New Belgium acquisition, I think they might have even been beforehand, but Ska Brewing out of Durango, quietly growing as, you know, this sleeping giant, so to speak, brewery here in Colorado.
Skanking giant.
Yeah. But announced earlier this month that they were going to be opening a combo brewery distillery in Boulder. And for those who aren't familiar, you know, the owners of Ska Brewing have kind of over the years diversified their portfolio by, you know, some of the partners are involved in different projects. They have, you know, one of their team, or, you know, one offshoot is Ska Fab, which, you know, most of the main owners are not involved with that, but Ska Fab is a manufacturing arm that supports the craft beer industry. There's also now Peach Street Distilling, which you know, Dave Thibodeau is also a partner in, but a distillery out in the Western Slope. Part of the crux of this announcement in Boulder is kind of this joining forces between Ska Brewing and Peach Street Distilling and finding out the proper way of licensing it so that they can have both a brewery and a distillery pub in Boulder. And so they're taking over the former Fate Brewing spot and will be opening up in 2020, but that will be able to serve both brewery beer products and distillery products. And then all of their you know, their Ska Brewing location in Durango and also the Peach Street Distilling location out in, I think, the Palisade area, will be able to serve each other's products as well. So,
oh, cool.
Very neat approach. And then the other side that kind of isn't fully baked out, no pun intended, is their investment or one of their partners' investment in CBD seltzer water by the name of Ojai. And again, we're diving into that a little bit deeper in an article later. But, you know, I think this is so interesting to see, you know, from a company that is looking at kind of more of an innovative approach towards growth and really diversifying their portfolio and bringing on these different branches that are also still very much within the realm of, you know, boozy adult beverage type items.
Or you can go as far as say as good time adult beverages.
Yeah, with good times.
I mean, CBD is, you know, it's more medicinal than anything, but still, you can have a good time when you're relaxing on some CBD.
Absolutely. So what is your take in looking at kind of this whole, you know, this whole slate of things that, you know, not necessarily everyone in Ska is involved with, but kind of a cool little, like, several different offshoots that are now starting to come together all in one.
I like it personally. I mean, from a business standpoint, it makes sense. I mean, if you have the means and ability to do a complementary product, something like that, you know, why not? It'll be interesting to see if they do any, how the branding will look, you know, if they're going to be completely separate, if there'll be any co-branding. But ultimately, it just seems like a natural way to go to me that way.
Absolutely.
It really actually opened my eyes, if I'm being honest. I mean, I've only really been working in the industry for about 2 years now. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of assumed, like, well, if you've got a brewing production license or brew pub license, you know, you can't mix and match like that. So for me, it's expanded my mindset on how a brewery business can grow. I always assumed it had to be brew pub or whatever, you know, tap room to distribution to whatever the next, you know, keep growing distribution. Now that expands and gives you different arms and different ways to expand. So I think that's cool from a business standpoint for me.
Absolutely. Well, cool, Sam. I really appreciate you joining me today. Once again, this has been episode 64 of the Porchcast. My name is Tristan, and joined once again by Sam Lael here, my co-host, and hopefully we'll be able to get the full crew back together for the next one. But in the meantime, be sure to follow us on all of your listening devices, whether that's Stitcher, iTunes, Apple Play, whatever it is. Be sure to give us a follow and give us a little positive rating if you're liking what you're listening to. We'll continue to serve up some really great beer discussions here moving forward on the Porchcast. And once again, a big thank you to our friends at On Tap Credit Union. Once again, with locations in Golden and Arvada, On Tap Credit Union has supported brewery employees for over 64 years. They listen carefully to your needs and make sure you have the right services, low-cost loans, and expert financial advice for you, your business, and your employees. Whatever your needs may be, tap into the services at On Tap Credit Union. That's www.ontapcu.org. Thanks again. We'll check you later.
I like what you're listening to? Be sure to follow the Porchcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and whatever listening devices you may follow. You can also follow Porch Drinking on Twitter and Instagram at @porchdrinkingco.